All right, well, I hit the dang button 15 seconds late. So that's going to screw up everything for the archive, but oh well. All right, well, it's going to be an antiwar.com kind of a show today. We got Phil Giraldi coming up and also John Glazer. Both from that esteemed website. That's right, antiwar.com. Write about everything for, what, 16 years now and counting. 17. I'll write about lots of things. All right, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're not on No Agenda today, just here at scotthorton.org. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Join up the chat room. Retweet me. Share me. Point your friends this direction. Especially on a day like today, you know, Thursday. When we're not on No Agenda, we need all the help we can get here. Oh, I know. You prefer to hear some lies about how this is the most popular show in America. There are millions of other people just like you listening right now. Millions. That's why I'm so rich. No, really, there's I don't know how many people listen. Thousands. I'll take it, you know. Eventually thousands, anyway. Before the end of the world, thousands of people will have heard this. So that's something. Uh-oh. A bunch of letters.exe has encountered a problem and needs to close. Oh, it's an AVG thing. Good job on your update there, guys. You're crashing during my live show. All right. So, yeah, Phil Giraldi's going to be here. He wrote this thing about Obama giving America's secrets to the Israelis. Obama giving America's secrets to the Israelis. Is that what I just said? That's what I meant to say. Really? Oh, yeah. And, you know, I mentioned this on the show. It's a Greenwald scoop, Edward Snowden, heroic, blown whistle. That got no coverage. Every one of these stories from the Verizon phone records on down has gotten coverage in the New York Times, the Washington Post, everywhere else. I was talking to you on the show the other day about how the New York Times didn't write about this, except their public editor. They have kind of their ombudsman. You know, the lady that writes for them but supposedly represents you. And I'm sorry, I forget her name now, but she actually is pretty good. And she wrote a thing calling out the editor of the Times that, hey man, how come we didn't run a story about Obama spying on Americans and then turning it all over to the Israelis? And his answer was, well, you know, we didn't think it was that newsworthy. Oh, yeah, that doesn't sound very newsworthy at all. Yeah, it's not because you were trying to just bury the story in silence. It's not like you have an agenda or anything. Not like you're terrified of being accused of the blood libel by Abe Foxman or something. Just, it wasn't really newsworthy that Obama made an agreement to turn over the NSA's catch to the Israelis. How many years did we spend here on the show talking about Verint and Naris and how they were invented, these software programs that the NSA uses to troll all the data? How many times have we talked about the fact that these are Israeli programs? And that in the case of the Australians, for example, they found out that, hey, you guys are using your update the software backdoor to take our stuff. And how it must be the case that that's happening to us, too. Remember the Fox News report after September 11th about all the Israelis spying and how the FBI was convinced that the Israelis were tapping their phones and how it was thwarting their terrorism investigation. Remember that? Oh, you don't remember that? Yeah, it's at informationclearinghouse.com. For some reason, you can't find it at the Fox News website anymore. Very New York Times-ish about them, wouldn't you say? But anyway, you can still find good reporting there by Carl Cameron. But anyway, so now it turns out that, no, don't worry about the Israelis tapping the NSA, breaking into the NSA's computers and stealing your data. Obama's just handing it all over to them. All right, I'm sorry. I'm going to shut up about that now because I'm going to save it for Phil Giraldi's interview. He's a former CIA officer, and he's written about Israeli spying in America before, and I'm certain, well, here he wrote an article all about it. A government answerable to no one. I'm not sure which government he's talking about there, ours or theirs, but yeah, I think ours. But anyway, yeah, that's a big deal. Phil Giraldi is going to be on to talk about that. And then John Glazer is going to be on to talk about the Syria thing. You know, I forgot to turn CNN on. CNN, that is, because you know, yesterday I tried to give other CNN a chance for a second, and it was horrible, man. It was all pop stars. Well, it was just a second that I gave them a chance. But, you know, there are three CNNs. There's Headline News, and then there's Wolf Blitzer CNN, and then there's Amanpour CNN, right? So I first went to Headline News, and they were talking about a pop star. So then I went to the other CNN, and then they were talking about a different pop star. And so then I turned it to CNN International, and they were talking about business news. Well, here they're talking about Iran, I guess, in the prospect of coming talks. And it's not like, you know, they're good on anything. It's just at least they're paying attention to important things. It's ridiculous, pop stars on CNN. Man, there's enough pop star news all over the world for people who are interested in pop star news. Which, by the way, what is it that makes people interested in pop star news? I don't get it. I really don't get it. Seriously. But anyway, that's not news, man. Sorry, I know I ain't original in complaining about that or anything, but that kind of bothers me. And especially pop stars nowadays, they're even more boring and uninteresting and stupid and ugly and lame than in my day. I'm an old man now. I've got dozens and dozens of gray hairs on my chin. You should see them. It's ridiculous. Back in my day, pop stars were lame and stupid and boring. And these are even worse. Anyway. So over here on CNN International, at least they're talking about something that matters.
It's unlikely they'll ever give them up. But it's certainly making a very political point here, which will not necessarily chime that easily with Washington.
So many moving parts. I'm Nick Paterwatt, trying to keep on top of them for us. We appreciate it. Thank you very much. Appreciate the analysis.
Yeah, yeah, great. Well, good timing there, Horton. Well, they were talking about Iran's nuclear program. I'm sure they were saying ridiculous things or who knows what. But anyway, at least they're paying attention to something that matters. Not like Iran's nuclear program matters. The controversy over it matters. Only because of people pretending that the program itself does. And you know what? That's what I should talk about for a minute here. I got a ton of news to cover, but I just want to tell you real quick, in case you're new at this, you don't really know. It took me a while to learn it because, you know, international treaties and nuclear technology and stuff, it's complicated. But I can make it real simple for you. And that is, there's a treaty called the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And what it says is, if you're a nuclear weapons state like America and Britain and France and China and Russia and Israel and India and Pakistan, oh, India and Pakistan and Israel aren't members of it. But anyway, If you're a nuclear weapons state and you're a member of it, like the UN Security Council states are, then you promise to get rid of your nukes someday, and of course they'll never do that, at least as far as their plan is. And then, if you're a non-nuclear weapons state, your signature to that very same treaty promises that you won't get nukes. You won't try to buy them, and you won't try to make them, and you're a non-nuclear weapons state, and you mean to stay that way. And in order to prove it all the time, you'll sign a safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is like the UN's ATF, right? And you'll sign an agreement with them that says that they can search your place without a warrant all the time, your gun shop, your nuclear facility, all the time, whenever they feel like, and make sure that you're not diverting any of your nuclear material to any military or other special purpose. So, that's what the Iranians got. And they have a civilian nuclear weapons program where they're enriching uranium up to 3.6%. a measly 3.6% industrial grade for their electricity program. And then they have also enriched a limited amount up to 20% enriched uranium-235, which, you know, if you dig uranium out of the ground, it's mostly 238. You have to enrich it and separate the 238 and the 235, the 235 being the sweet stuff that you can make electricity or bombs out of. So anyway, or use for those purposes. So anyway, the Iranians have a safeguards agreement, and they're within their safeguards agreement, and they're not in violation of it. And people trump up this and that little minor controversy about it. But the fact of the matter is, and here's your direct quote coming, the International Atomic Energy Agency, quote, has continued to verify the non-diversion of declared nuclear material in Iran to any military or other special purpose. So in other words, they're tracking the uranium as it comes out of the ground, as it's converted to, you know, kind of cleaned up into yellow cake, uranium ore, and then as it's converted to uranium hexafluoride gas at their Isfahan facility there, and then as it's introduced into the centrifuges at Natanz and Fordo and enriched up to 3.6 and or 20% uranium-235, and then they keep track of where it all goes, whether it's waiting to be used or whether it's actually being used. And what you'll hear them crying about most, the Americans and the Israelis, is that the Iranians are enriching up to 20%, which they like to pretend might as well be 90%, and it's really 94%+ that you need to make a bomb. That's weapons grade, 90%+, really 94%+ uranium-235. And they like to pretend that, you know, if you just take some 20% and, you know, stare at it for a day or something, it'll turn into a bomb. It sure as hell ain't that easy. But I guess it is obviously closer than 3.6%. But anyway, it's all there. It's all being, the 20% is actually being used up faster than the 3.6%. They're converting it to, I guess first they make it dust, and then somehow they compress it or melt it and combine it, something, I don't know, and make fuel plates, targets for their medical isotope reactor that the United States built for them. Was it General Dynamics? I forgot. Built the Iranian Tehran Research Facility nuclear reactor there in Tehran. Its purpose is making medical isotopes for, you know, how people get radiation, radioactive dye put in their blood so that the doctors can see flaws in your endocrine system or whatever the hell, or radiation treatment for cancer therapy. That's what these are used for. And in fact, the Canadians were the last people producing, with the last plant in the world producing this stuff. And this is sorely needed, not just for Iran, but for that entire part of the world. I guess that's the way they say it anyway. I don't know why this part of the world doesn't still need one if the Canadians are closing theirs down. But anyway, none of this has a damn thing to do with making bombs. They're just not making bombs. And the Ayatollah might have a funny hat, and he might be ugly, and maybe you can't understand the things he says when he talks in his crazy language that he talks and whatever, but he ain't stupid. And he does know that if he started trying to make a nuke, the Americans and the Israelis would know it and would start a war and might just kill him and destroy his Ayatollah rule over there and probably stop them from being able to make a nuke, you know, at least in the short term, with their gigantic carpet bombing campaigns and maybe even including nuclear weapons. I mean, you and I would try to stop them from doing it, but it's pretty much a safe bet from Netanyahu's point of view that that's what America, I mean, from Rouhani's point of view, from the Ayatollah Khamenei's point of view, that that's what the Americans and the Israelis would do if they started making a bomb. They know that. Seymour Hersh reports that the CIA and the American military believe that the only reason the Iranians ever even considered looking at, you know, paperwork on making a bomb way back at the turn of the century was as a method, or even back into the 1990s, was as a method to keep Saddam Hussein out. after all the poison gas that America and the rest of the Western countries helped him use against Iran back in the 1980s, they wanted to deter him against the mad dog of the Middle East. But once they were successful at using Ahmed Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress to lie to the Israeli Fifth Column in America and promise that a new democratic Shiite Iraq would be beneficial for Israel and convince them to overthrow Saddam Hussein for them, and the Iranians convincing the American neoconservatives to overthrow Saddam Hussein for the Iranians, then that problem was solved. So they didn't even need to worry about that. All right. Anyway, so point being, you will hear a hue and a cry. You even heard it from Ali Gharib on the show yesterday that, you know, boo-hoo, Iran is breaking the international law by enriching uranium. Yeah, but who ever gave the UN Security Council the right to dictate that Iran may not enrich uranium? They don't have that right. There is no article in the UN Charter that gives them that authority. At all. The Iranians have signed up. It's a sovereign state over there, an independent state, the crux of the problem. They have signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and they have agreed to not make nuclear bombs. They have agreed to let the IAEA continue to verify that they're not diverting nuclear material to any military or other special purpose. They have not agreed to abide by whatever whim that the UN Security Council comes up with. And here's how you figure this, okay? What if the UN Security Council, I don't know, Samantha Power was sick that day, and the UN Security Council mandated that America has to do this, that, and the other thing. Sorry, Charlie. We're an independent sovereign state. You can't tell us whether we can enrich uranium or not. I mean, of course, a lot of us can think of a lot of things that we would like somebody to force the U.S. government to stop doing. Make nuclear weapons would be high on my list, but I sure as hell don't want the United Nations telling them to do it. You gotta have these matters enforced from the bottom up. Anyway, the United States, regardless of what I want or what you want, the United States government would tell the UN to go to hell. Can't tell us what to do. That's not what the international law is for. The international law is for us to tell you. Now, America does have to abide by the treaties our government signs. Not like it's really enforceable by anyone but themselves. But the Iranians are not in violation of their treaty obligations. They're only in violation of what the UN Security Council has dictated. And they have every right. In fact, the entire UN Security Council, permanent membership of the Security Council, that is the alliance that won World War II, basically, the United States, Britain, France, Russia, China, they are all members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which means they are all sworn to respect Iran's unalienable right to nuclear technology for peaceful purposes. So these resolutions that they have, these extra resolutions with these extra demands they've put on Iran, are all illegal and illegitimate. Iran has no call to have to abide by those at all, just by the NPT. And they can withdraw from the NPT if they want to. Although it would be a bad idea, I ain't recommending it. All right. Probably some NSA stuff, maybe a little bit of Africa when we get back, and then Phil Giraldi. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why Peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In the war state, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all. Let me adjust this mic here, man. Man, I need to turn the ringer on my phone off. All right, I'm Scott. I'm drinking not even lukewarm coffee. It's cool now at this point, I think. Where's the rest of that? That's it, huh? Yeah. I had to replace them harmonicas with the whole song. So that way, in case I'm in the other room getting some coffee to just play for a while, you know? Alright, well, I was actually looking forward to listening to a little bit of that. Yeah. Anyway, hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back to the show. ScottHorton.org is the website. Check out the chat room there. ScottHorton.org/chat. And hang out with the boys and girls. Looks like there's a dozen people in there and nobody's saying anything to each other. I got the quietest chat room in the world. Well, go in there and start up a conversation about El Caminos or something. Something interesting. Something boring. You know what it is? They're all listening with rapt attention to my brilliance. Probably not. I don't know. Anyway. So, okay, I think I'm done talking about Iran's nuclear program. I guess let me just say, you know, to emphasize the point. They're not making nukes. Everybody who ever said they were making nukes, they're all liars. The whole thing's a giant red herring. Well, the Israelis are terribly paranoid and terrified about the prospect of Iran ever getting a nuclear bomb because that could limit their ability to be the regional hegemon towering over their... cowering knaves. The problem with that is, their whole, our boot on your neck equals peace theory hadn't worked this whole time anyway. It's suicide for Israel anyway. They're completely stupid. But anyway, that's their policy. Is they want to be the regional hegemon. And if Iran has nukes, then that sort of just nips that in the bud. It means that they would have to consider the possibility that someone could ever fight back against them for what they do to people. And that's an existential threat. We can't conquer all the land all the way to the Euphrates River, then, well, that's just sad. And, you know, the Americans are mad that the Iranians declared independence back in 1979. We're the evil British Empire, and we don't countenance that kind of thing very good. Very well. Yeah. Anyway. But so what they really want is regime change. I don't know whether they've really given up on it or not. You know, Obama said that he's given up on regime change in the speech. You know, I meant to ask Stephen Walt about that, but I forgot. I should ask John Glazer about that. John Glazer is of strong opinions about regime change in Iran. Try to bring that up to him. Obama did specifically say in the speech, look, this isn't about regime change. It's just about you doing everything else we say. Right, yeah, okay. I don't know. But really, the nuclear program is mostly a red herring. And as Stephen Walt did point out on the show the other day, and everybody else pointed this out too, if the Israelis don't have Iran to point and scream about, then what excuse do they have for corralling American power the way they have? If America's friends with every state in the region, more or less, You know, don't forget, Assad tortured people for George Bush wholesale. It wasn't just Mar-a-Rar. There were a lot more than that. So they weren't quite our sock puppets, but we can get along. We'll flip-flop back and forth on that one. That's certainly Syria is no threat to Israel either way. So, if America's friends with everybody in the region, why can't Israel be friends with everybody in the region? And if Israel's friends with everybody in the region, then how come we got to give them $30 billion? And all the latest Lockheed products? For that matter, subsidizing their socialist education and healthcare system. What in the hell? You know, money is fungible. So, American military aid to Israel is just subsidy for, you know, every socialist program there that they can afford because you're paying their way on military issues, you know? It's ridiculous. And the excuse for that, the reason you're paying, you know, you can't afford to send your kid to college because you're sending Israeli kids to college is because of the terrible threat of Iran, man, and blah, blah, whatever. It's completely ridiculous, but still, that's the excuse for it all. Right? Jordan's no threat. Egypt's no threat. Iraq's no threat. Saudi's no threat. Who's a threat to Israel? Maybe if there was a tsunami in the Mediterranean Sea. So that's a big part of it, is just always having something to complain about because the Iranians will not give up their nuclear program. Or I don't know, actually, Ali Gharib seemed to think that maybe they would, that's why they created in the first place. For a little bit of respect and something to bargain away. They did offer to negotiate the entire thing back in 2003. Remember that? The golden offer. That was before they ever started enriching at all. No, it may be too late. Now it's a matter of national prestige and everything, you know what I mean? And anyway, as long as I'm on Iran, I'll go ahead and talk about the Mujahideen-e-Khalq. There's a communist terrorist cult called the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, and they really are a cult in the sense of like Bo and T, the Heaven's Gate cult. Castrate yourself and wear purple pajamas and Nikes and chase the comet. I mean, crazy cult. They got their own Bo and T in the form of, Rajavi. The husband is missing, presumed dead, I guess. I don't know. The wife leads it now. And they're communists, and they're terrorists, and they're a cult. And they used to work, they killed Americans back in fighting for Iranian independence from the empire back in the late 1970s during the revolution. And, you know, fought basically as shock troops for the Ayatollah Khomeini. And then he turned on them and drove them out of Iran. Well, they turned on him probably. And then they ended up working for Saddam Hussein, and then America inherited them after that. And they're the ones who come up with most of the lies about what Iran is up to these days. And just look at MondoWeiss.net today for the American politicians in bed with this communist terrorist cult, the MEK. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Man, I always wanted to go and be in the audience on The Price is Right when I lived in L.A. It was, like, what, 4 or 5 miles from where I lived in Hollywood. I didn't really want to be a contestant, but that would have been cool to be on there, man, because every time I had a cold when I was a kid, I'd watch The Price is Right. Price is Right, you know? I guess Bob Barker's all long gone now, though. Drew Carey. Is it Drew Carey's show now? He's the guy. Well, the most recent one that I heard saying that libertarianism is republicanism only, conservatism only with pot smoking. Yeah, for the illiterate, maybe. Maybe for someone who doesn't know anything about anything. Jesus Christ, where do they find these people? Do your little game show, dude. By the way, in case you're new, libertarianism is the entire antithesis of conservatism. Sorry, I'm off on a tangent. Alright. Hey there, chatting in the chat room. Yay! Join up the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat. Hey, Sneaker. How many people are listening to the show right now? I happen to be in a Skype chat with Sneaker right now. Can you hear me, Sneaker? What's the dang deal? I want to know. Don't go away, folks. Phil Giraldi coming up, I swear. By the way, I'm going to mention again my article that I wrote for the Future of Freedom. Because I think it's a really big deal that Jacob Hornberger went ahead and put this thing online. The way they do it is they write stuff all the time there at the Future Freedom Foundation, but they have their journal, The Future of Freedom, that where all the best stuff goes. And you heard the commercial for it a little while back. And the thing is, it's a subscription thing, and it's part of what helps keep the Future Freedom Foundation in business. Subscriptions to the Future of Freedom. That's at fff.org/subscribe. But then what happened was some Al-Shabaab terrorists, I'm watching actually replay some of the footage from inside the mall on CNN right now, some Al-Shabaab terrorists attacked a mall in Nairobi, Kenya. And the great Sheldon Richman, editor of the Future of Freedom, vice president of the Future of Freedom Foundation, he wrote a thing going, oh yeah, hey, this is all America's fault in a manner of speaking kind of a thing. And quoting my article that I wrote for the Future of Freedom. But then, so Eric Garris wanted to run the thing on antiwar.com, so I asked Jacob Hornberger if it would be okay if he went ahead and put, oh, my article that I wrote. Yeah, I mentioned that. I asked Jacob Hornberger if it would be okay if he went ahead and put that subscription-only article online early, very early, so that we could have it for context for these very, very current events breaking. And he went ahead and did it, no problem. And they posted it, and antiwar.com is linking to it today. If you go and look at the viewpoint section at antiwar.com, it's called U.S. Government Responsible for Somalia's Misery. And I believe yesterday they ran Sheldon's article, I forget the title now, which was elaborating on that. I might have the tab open here to Sheldon's thing. No, I closed it. Anyway, so the thing is, the only reason that there's an Al-Shabaab militia is because America's intervention in Somalia. It's the consequence of the American government killing people that these killers have risen up to oppose them and their sock puppet proxy armies. Simple as that. They fought for years before they declared loyalty to Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda's goals. And they weren't in Kenya until Kenya was in Somalia. Well, I don't know. They say there was some harassment at the border, but then now I'm trying to remember what it was. Hey, maybe chat room guys, you could help me out with this. Wasn't there a thing that said that there were doubts cast about whether Al-Shabaab had actually really attacked these resorts on the Kenyan border? And that maybe there was a little bit of exaggeration and hyperbole and perhaps even false flag kind of a nature of an excuse for a war there. I'm trying to remember where I read that one. I don't think it was Thomas Mountain. I think it was somebody else. Yeah. Anyways, so it's all America's fault. And now the New York Times headline from today. Here, wait, I have it. I want to get it right, so you have to wait a second while I click around. The headline of the New York Times today, U.S. sees direct threat in attack at Kenya Mall. See that? History began last week. Or history began, I don't know, whenever Al-Shabaab came into existence because Islam mandates evil doing. And so something's got to be done about it, right? It's so easy, isn't it? Oh, hey, look, everybody, a problem we created. Oh, I mean, look, a problem. And now they can begin intervening in Somalia. So says Jeffrey Gettleman from his hotel lobby. What a disaster. And again, the worst consequence of the American war in Somalia is the famine. That's what my article is about, is the famine. And the context of the famine is a drought in the middle of a war that America caused. And so where market capitalism had abolished famine from virtually everywhere in the world where it existed at all, including Somalia, the American war there brought it back. Their quite rudimentary market system broke down. Their obviously their many crops failed in the first place, and then but whatever was harvested couldn't be sold. First of all, nobody had any money to buy it, but also nobody had any ability to distribute it. All their markets, literal and figurative, had been destroyed by the American war. And a quarter of a million people starved to death. Weakest first. Youngest first. And you know what? Especially for you religious types who tend to believe things like Pat Robertson says about how God judges nations, right? God will cause a great Chicago fire over sodomy going on down there in New Orleans. Because God is a collectivist like that. He is Israeli, after all, you know. Collective punishment and everything. Well, how do you think God feels about America, you know, all of us, between Miami and Portland, San Diego and Bangor? Or, you know, that Portland. And there are Portland and Maine, too. How do you think God feels about us doing what we have done to the helpless little people of Somalia in East Africa? The tiniest, weakest, crappiest little nation in the history of the world. If I was God, I would be seeking vengeance against America for their sinfulness, you know. And it, you know what? It really is a purely simple black and white issue. Sorry to, you know, make a crude pun. It's good and evil, up and down, black and white. There's no gray area here. The Americans are wrong. The American military, the American CIA, the American State Department, the American White Houses are the agents of evil. And what they have done to Somalia is just completely unforgivable. It's unreal. And you don't hear people saying nice things about Mussolini in Ethiopia. That's what this is. You know, this is worse, probably. I don't know. How many people did Mussolini kill in Ethiopia? Did he starve a quarter of a million of them to death? Including their babies? Oh, no, but Scott, we got red, white, and blue and beer and baseball games, and we're between Canada and Mexico, and so that means that when we commit sins, they become virtues. God's never mad at America, certainly not for what we ever do to foreigners. He might be mad at, you know, men touching each other down there in New Orleans. He might send a whole nation to hell for that. Gross. Boys kissing. Yuck. But no, if America starves every last Somali baby to death, God's just fine with that because we're exceptional. We're Americans and red, white, and blue and Pledge of Allegiance and a bunch of ridiculous slogans and nonsense. Hey, I'm from here. Right? I'm from here. So whatever the American Pentagon does is great. You see the ipso facto there? You see the cause and effect? I'm from here, so you can't talk bad about Obama for killing children. About George W. Bush for killing children. After all, they're democratically elected. That makes them more legitimate than God himself, right? Democratically elected. Well, I don't care who it is, you have to respect the office of the presidency. How many times you hear that? That's the worst thing about Bill Clinton. He disgraced the office of our great leaders. Barack Obama, why, he usurped that great office by being a Kenyan secret agent. You have to respect the office. No matter how many babies they kill, if they kill every black baby in Africa, fine, right? That's what exceptionalism means. Sins become virtues when they're committed by us. Doesn't that sound stupid? Who believes in that? Let me ask you this. What if the Americans and the Canadians had fought at different times in different ways and the northern parallel border there, I forget, what parallel is that? The 36th or something, the border between America and Canada? Whatever it is, I have no idea. I'm just guessing compared to Korea in my head. I don't have a map in front of me. Whatever parallel that is, what if that parallel was in a different place? What if, say, you know, North Dakota and everything north, you know, that from that parallel up, were all in Canada? But those same people hired a government to murder a bunch of children. Would it still be exceptional? Or what if the border went all the way up into Canada? Would that mean that anybody that those measly Canucks murdered, that would be okay? As long as they were, you know, within the hegemony of America's legal system. Right? If the Democrats' invasion of Canada had worked back in 1812 and they had conquered all of Canada and kept it for themselves, and that was the USA, was all of Canada too, would that mean that a bunch of, you know, people who say A and hoser and things all the time and play hockey, that when they murder children, that would become virtuous too? Or would it mean that it never happened? All of a sudden, there's Al-Shabaab for no reason. It has nothing to do with that they're the survivors of a dead family or anything. With, you know, anything to fight for that they could articulate. Nah, you know what it is? Islam turns good people evil and makes them hate good things. That's all you need to know, okay? Yeah, those Somalis, they're nice little, you know, they could be our nice little pets, but the Islam got them. It's so sad. Islam got them and made them evil. Oh, I know they've been Muslims all this time. Never a threat before. Except to each other. Anyway, I don't know, man. I guess like I was saying the other day, I have an extra chip on my shoulder about the Somalia thing because no one else seems to care at all. So I gotta try to extra make up for it a little bit. Which, you know, raises the question, how come I don't talk about Iraq all the time anymore? I guess I'm as burned out on Iraq as you, and I guess, you know, the American soldiers are there in much smaller numbers than before. Much smaller. I mean, there's still a huge diplomatic presence at the embassy in Baghdad, and there are still spies, and presumably, I guess, some Air Force people, right? And the Marines guarding the embassy. But pretty freaking much the occupation is over. The Iranians had the Iraqis kick our asses out. Thanks for the help taking over Baghdad, said the Shiite parties, their United Iraqi Alliance. Now beat it. So there's not too much left there. Witness John Kerry's hollow protestations. I guess not hollow, but ineffective. Protestations over Nouri al-Maliki allowing the Iranian government to fly weapons and men and material to Syria all the time to help back Assad. But there's still a huge civil war going on. The Sunni-based insurgency versus the United Iraqi Alliance government, just like it has been since 2005. And there was sort of kind of a ceasefire. It's what they called the surge worked. When the insurgency basically at least called a ceasefire to their war against the Americans, because they figured they couldn't fight the Americans, the new Iraqi government, and al-Qaeda at the same time. And they had their problems with al-Qaeda. It was getting way out of hand. So they made a deal with the Americans. The local Sunni Iraqis made a deal with the Americans. We'll stop fighting you. They'd already lost Baghdad at that point. This is 2006. End of 06. They were already fighting al-Qaeda before Petraeus showed up and made the deal. We'll pay you to keep fighting al-Qaeda, to limit their influence, and we'll let you patrol your own neighborhoods and quit fighting you. And we promise we'll make Maliki integrate you into the government and give you a real democratic say in the parliament and power sharing. And yeah, right. None of that ever happened. None of those benchmarks were ever met. The surge, in fact, did not work except in getting the Sunni-based insurgency to stop fighting the Americans for a while. But they kept fighting the Iraqi government, varying degrees of intensity. Of course, the other part of the surge, the main part of the surge, was attacking Muqtada al-Sadr, who to this day is the most powerful member of the United Iraqi Alliance that America put in power there. They were trying to limit his influence on behalf of the Dawa Party and the Supreme Islamic Council, but that didn't work. In fact, al-Hakim, the old man that ran the Supreme Islamic Council, fell down dead. And his son was kind of a Rockefeller Jr. type, ineffectual. And so Sadr usurped the entire Supreme Islamic Council. And so now it's just down to Sadr and the Dawa Party, and their alliance is the Shiite government of Iraq. That entire war of 2007 in eastern Baghdad, mostly, against the Sadrists, which got a lot of American soldiers and a hell of a lot of Iraqi fighters and civilians killed, was all for nothing. They're fighting the people they're fighting for. It's completely ridiculous. Read David Finkel, The Good Soldiers. It comes up like twice in there with a Lieutenant Colonel Kozlarich, war criminal. Sworn testimony on my radio show by two men under his command, Josh Stieber and Ethan McCord, that they were ordered to kill civilians by Lieutenant Colonel Kozlarich. War criminal. Guilty war criminal. Kozlarich. But anyway, it comes up once in the book by him, and then I think one of the enlisted men is wondering out loud about it or something too, that, hey, wait a minute. Isn't the Sadrists that we're fighting against, aren't they the keystone in the gigantic United Iraqi Alliance party that we are fighting for, that is the government of Iraq? That's funny. The entire rest of the U.S. Army and Marine Corps, Air Force and Marines fighting in Iraq are fighting for this man and his men while we're fighting against them in this one neighborhood. How odd. Oh, well. Get back to committing war crimes, men. You've got your orders. Get out there and 360-degree fire. If any roadside bomb goes off, Collective punishment. That'll teach them. That'll make God like us. Kill a bunch of civilians. He approves of that kind of thing, apparently. So yeah, if it's a matter of which story does the media ignore the most, I should be focusing on Iraq more. Lord knows, antiwar.com continues to do great work on Iraq. Margaret and Jason both do great work on Iraq, and it's been really bad over there. Hold a funeral, get it bombed. Talk about hard feelings, man. They may be fighting for a long, long time. And by the way, yes, it's a Sunni-Shia split in Iraq and in the region, but it's not that they're fighting over trying to convert each other. And nobody ever said that, okay? Oh, you have to be a Sunni now or anything like that. It's just these are how the political lines are drawn. These are where the divisions are. You know, that's, it's like that in America too to a degree, but in the old world especially, you know, people divide themselves by tribe, by ethnicity, by religious belief, by language, and brutally so. By religious sect. For the most part, in America nowadays anyway, and it's taken a hell of a long time to get here, but for the most part in America, unless somebody's got a real bent about it, I think most Americans don't even know whether their friends or neighbors are Catholics or Protestants or anything else. I mean, unless it's obvious that you're a Sikh or something, or Jewish, stand out. But for the most part, between Catholic and Protestant white people, the white majority in America, they don't even know what church each other go to or care anymore. That's all long over with. No one care about that. And, you know, in most of our major cities anyway, people of all different, you know, so-called tribes and sects and ethnicities and other differences from the old world get along just fine, live right next to each other, work at the same offices, use the same bogus currency, speak the same language of ridiculous, you know, celebrity pop culture nonsense that everybody cares so much about. We're getting better at seeing past the superficial differences and, you know, judging each person by the content of their character. In the old world, they're really bad about it, and especially in places where America comes and bombs their entire country off the face of the earth. Turns everything upside down. Turns sect against sect for American imperial purposes. Instead of trying to help the Islamic Reformation, you know, paper over these differences so that everybody can get along in peace and trade. Just radicalize everybody against each other. And toward their core beliefs, because, you know, when your whole family's dead, that's all you've got, right? Yeah, anyway, so I guess I do need to do a better job of paying attention to Iraq some more. I'm like you, man. I got burned out on it. I spent a long time maligning all of y'all, everybody, for not caring about Iraq. Oh, I loved cheering for the Iraq War back when they were getting it started, but now that all the consequences are coming due, I've decided to go golfing now, you all said. And I hated you for it. But now look at me. I've burnt myself out on talking about it. The only time I ever talk about it on the show is when I interview Patrick Coburn, who, by the way, is still traveling around and apparently can't ever be reached except for off hours. I keep getting emails from him saying, oh, sorry, I was in the air at the time. Oh, sorry about your email. Anyways. Giraldi and Glazer coming up. Don't go away. I don't want to talk about Bill Kristol. I was going to talk about Bill Kristol, but I don't want to talk about Bill Kristol. I don't know what happened to Nick Turse, but I'm just going to keep spamming him until he comes on the damn show. I like Nick Turse. I wonder if Nick Turse doesn't like me. It's possible that he doesn't. It's also possible he's just really busy or he's off on vacation somewhere or hell, I don't know, man. But he wrote two really important things that I want to talk to him about. And I figure, you know, that I want you to read is the point. I think it's more likely that you'll read the thing if I interview the guy that wrote him. That's kind of the point of the show. The first one is co-authored with the great Bob Dreyfus at thenation.com, America's Afghan Victims. Even among staunchly anti-war politicians and pundits, few bother to mention the cost of the war to civilians. Ain't that the case? And then his other one is a Tom Dispatch piece that ran at antiwar.com, of course under Tom Engelhardt's name is how it works there at antiwar.com, with all his different co-authors. AFRICOM's gigantic small footprint. Oh, okay, this is the third most important story on Earth. After America's nuclear relationship with Russia and the civilian casualties in Afghanistan. Anyway, so I want Nick Turse on the show. By the way, if you haven't read his book about Vietnam, read it. Man, that thing is a hell of a thing. Kill anything that moves. The reason he called it that is because when he went through the records, the U.S. Army paperwork on all the war crimes, their own investigations, internal army investigations of war crimes committed in Vietnam, what he found over and over and over again was that the orders were kill anything that moves. And you know, I kind of owe the world an apology for this. I always knew it, but I still kind of couldn't quite get my head around it all the way, right? I still kind of sort of had it wrong. That there was anyone in South Vietnam that America was fighting for other than the sock puppet government and its parasites. It's not just that they canceled the election because the northern commies would have won. They canceled the election because the commies would have won in the south, too, the election had been held only in the south. They simply invaded Vietnam and killed everyone who lived in South Vietnam to prevent them from going red, basically. Or else we'd have had to pay the market price for tungsten. That's what Ike Eisenhower said was the whole point. Got to get that tungsten. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new project, Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. They've got two new audiobooks read by the deepest voice in libertarianism, the great historian Jeff Riggenbach. Our Last Hope, Rediscovering the Lost Path to Liberty by Michael Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center is available now. And Beyond Democracy, co-authored by Frank Karsten of the Mises Institute Netherlands and journalist Carl Beckman will be released this month. And they're only just getting started. So check out listenandthink.com. You may be able to get your first audiobook absolutely free. That's Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. I'm at scotthorton.org. We don't do no agenda on Thursdays. We're preempted. But we're streaming at scotthorton.org. You can find all the interview archives there. Almost 3,000 of them now going back to 2003. And also, join up the chat room there at scotthorton.org/chat. During the live show, especially here at 11 to 1 Eastern Time every day. And you can also follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. At slash Scott Horton Show. So retweet me, because my tweets are great. Yeah. All right. First up on the show today is Phil Giraldi. He is a former CIA and DIA officer. He's the executive director of the Council for the National Interest Foundation, and he writes for the American Conservative Magazine and Antiwar.com, both. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How the hell are you?
I'm fine, Scott. How about you?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us today. A government answerable to no one. But then the article is about America and Israel, and I can't figure out which one you're talking about is the least answerable to who.
Well, in a sense, you could argue that the United States government is answerable to Israel.
But they are answerable to somebody, just not us.
Yeah. I mean, the implication was that what I meant by the title was that the United States is not answerable to its own people.
Yeah, apparently not, and of course, neither is the American media either, I guess, or to their own ombudsman. Well, tell us about this. This is a huge story that came out of the Snowden leaks. I don't know exactly how you rank it in hugeness to the other NSA stories, but I think it's almost without dispute, it's got to be the one that's gotten the least attention.
Yeah, it's you know, it always gets the least attention when it's about Israel, unfortunately. But the this was a document that was published by the Guardian, which of course was one of the recipients of the Snowden of some of the Snowden leaks, and it basically is a memorandum of understanding issued by the National Security Agency in 2009, discussing the rules or the parameters for giving raw information. In other words, this is the information that the NSA collects in its sweeps of American telecommunications. It apparently has been giving large quantities of this information in a raw form, including information which, because it's raw, it includes information on lots of American citizens, and just been giving this stuff to Israel.
And now, are we talking about all the information that's in every one of the leaks that came out already? So all our phone metadata and our Google searches and the information at rest and the information in transit and the information all over the place, the 215 and the 207 and the everything?
That would seem to be the implication. That's precisely what we're talking about here. All the information that they basically suck up like a huge vacuum cleaner, they've been sharing with Israel. Now, it's not clear from the memo exactly how they select what they, what huge chunk of info they're giving them or not giving them, but it is also clear from the memo that this does include considerable amounts of information on U.S. citizens, which is the purpose of the memo, basically saying to the Israelis, hey, we expect you to, observe the same rules we observe about U.S. citizens, which, as we know, is virtually none. So it's kind of a funny memo. It says, yeah, we're going to give you all this stuff. You can use it, but you got to use it the same way we use it. And by the way, we have no way of punishing you if you abuse that privilege.
Right. Yeah, or any way of knowing really what you're doing with it. And by the way, whatever you find out about our senators, please ignore it.
never
blackmail them or anything.
Yeah, one of the funniest lines in it, of course, is the fact that anything relating to government officials, the Israelis are supposed to destroy immediately. But the fact is, of course, there is no way of checking that they're doing that. I think, on the contrary, if they have stuff relating to government officials, particularly if it's blackmail-type stuff, they're probably putting it in a special file.
This is so ridiculous. You know, I don't know. For years we talked about Bamford's book, The Shadow Factory, and how Naris and Verint were in these software programs that the NSA uses to surf all of our stuff, to sift it all, that these were invented by Israeli companies, and that there's every reason to suspect that the backdoors that they build in so they can update the software all the time are useful for stealing whatever they want, and how the Australians figured that that's what had happened to them. And of course, there's the Carl Cameron series and all the reporting about, you know, the FBI's concerns about their phones being tapped by the Israelis around the time of the 9/11 attacks, et cetera, and interfering with their investigation. apparently, no, the government just gives them everything. They're not stealing it. They've got permission. It's like LBJ calling back the planes during the USS Liberty thing. This is sanctioned from the very, very top.
Yeah, that's to me the most disturbing aspect of the story. I mean, who's to blame the Israelis for taking what we're giving them, for God's sakes? I mean, we're giving them the house, we're giving them everything we have. But who is the idiot at the top of the food chain? I think his name is Obama, who basically approves this kind of stuff. And why is it the American public up in arms about it? Well, it's partly because the media didn't report it. You know, why isn't the NSA being forced to answer questions about what exactly is going on here? It's quite amazing.
Well, and just think, I mean, the imagination could just run wild on what dirt must they have on our congressmen, our federal judges, our senators. I mean, these people, by definition, are powerful, ambitious, you know, very self-interested type of people. They're virtually all of them guilty of the kinds of things in their personal lives that regular people don't do. I mean, they're ruthless personalities, most of them, right? Like that LA Times story says, like, well, that's interesting. The personality traits of psychopaths and politicians are actually very similar.
Sure, and it's kind of like the Jane Harmon story, you know, where, you know, once they get something on you, they've got something on you, and that's basically the way the whole system works. And then, you know, but of course, our system of criminal justice means that we get a clown like Eric Holder, who's responsible for deciding if any prosecution is going to go forward, and all these people just walk even if something does come out. And this is a particularly pernicious example of what's going on because it involves a foreign country, and it involves a foreign country that is a gross net recipient of American money and political support and everything else. And here we're doing something that is not even necessarily in the Israeli interest. I mean, you know, all right, so they're compiling a lot of dossiers on Americans. That just shows how venal we are. But the fact is that we're just giving them stuff, and it's stuff like, you know, maybe this phone call we're having right now will be in the next dump. I wouldn't be too surprised. It's just astonishing. It's like the civil liberties that we assumed we had a few years ago, we're discovering increasingly is don't exist, and nobody seems to care.
Well, and you know, I mean, the question is raised too: what use is this to the Israelis other than domestic politics? It's not like there's a bunch of Al-Qaeda plots being hatched in North America against Israel or Hezbollah ones either.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the argument they would make is that, sure, there are Jewish and Israeli targets in the United States. But, you know, that's up to the FBI to take care of that, and it's up to the NSA to deal with the FBI and law enforcement in this country if there's a threat against Israeli or Jewish sources, Jewish sites and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's a non-argument. It's just that here are the Israelis, and they figure, okay, if they're going to give us this stuff, we're going to take it.
All right, now, so let's talk a little bit about your view of the CIA, and obviously you're very critical of it and have been for a long, long time. That's a pretty common view from inside the CIA, or at least with retired CIA guys. They all seem to like Israel all that much. What is that about?
Well, because most CIA guys, either whether they were analysts or whether they were operations officers like myself, came into contact regularly with Israelis or Israeli interests, and most of us, being thinking human beings and not very political, realized that essentially the U.S. was getting screwed on this relationship on a regular basis. That's why I think you see so many intelligence officers who surface and are critical of that relationship, because they would be critical of a similar relationship if it were with China or with Russia or with anybody else. But it's the question of the special relationship is with Israel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay.
Oh, yeah, I remember Christopher Ketchum wrote a piece for Counterpunch once that began, "Scratch a former intelligence officer," or maybe even says current or former American intelligence officer, and they will start talking about how much they hate Israel, basically, and start, you know, ticking off on their fingers all the different things that Israel did to screw America, that America just took it.
Yeah, that's basically the truth. I mean, when you get up to the policymaking level, where you have the director of central intelligence and people like that, yeah, sure, they're politicians essentially. So what they say has nothing to do with what working people in the intelligence agencies think. And I'll qualify that. I have met one working level CIA officer in my entire time who was extremely pro-Israeli. And that's it, one. And virtually every other one, where you open the Pandora's box and mention Israel, it comes out. And they really are aware of the fact that this relationship has done terrible damage to the United States and continues to do so. And you hear it. And you hear it from Foreign Service officers, too, I mean, to be fair about it. And many of them are just as concerned as intelligence officers.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny, I guess, kind of back to the New York Times thing. It's funny, just the discrepancy, I guess, still to this day between the common narrative about Israel and the reality of the situation. For example, since 1993 and the first World Trade Center bombing, the bin Ladenites have been saying that one of the things that makes them want to attack America and Americans all the time is our support for Israel. Right or wrong, it seems like that ought to be a matter of discussion. And what is it about Israel that they're complaining about? Its very existence, or is it more specific, like, say, the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip and southern Lebanon and things like that? And it's not a matter of, geez, guys, let's go negotiate with Zawahiri and give in to all of his demands or anything like that. But, you know, it's like Michael Scheuer said, we ought to be able to have a debate about this where even if you say, you know what, whatever terrorist consequences come from our relationship with Israel, let's at least have an honest discussion about let the democracy decide or whatever, you know, is this the kind of price we're willing to pay? And yet after all this time, still they get away with pretending that, well, terrorists hate us because they're terrorists and they're terrorists and they're terrorists and yay Israel, as though these things have nothing to do with each other.
Yeah, that's the fundamental issue. I think that most people who are a lot more knowledgeable of the Arab world than I am would say that there is hardly anyone that any more questions the existence of Israel. And basically what we're talking about is Israeli policies, what Israel does, what it is seen nightly on television throughout the Arab world and the Muslim world in general, doing to the Palestinians, the stuff that's not reported in the U.S. media, and unfortunately not even reported very much on Al Jazeera America, I'm ashamed to say. So you don't see this kind of stuff in America, but the rest of the world is seeing it, and they know perfectly well what the issues are. So it's how Israel behaves. Just as the criticism of the United States is about how the United States behaves, and it's not our existence or our freedoms or the fact that Israel exists.
Yeah, I mean, and you think about how skewed all the coverage is. I can't think of a single time where I've seen on cable news where they put up a map of Israel and Palestine and said, all right, the yellow area here is Israel proper, and then the other color here, whatever it is, that's the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip where the Palestinians live but don't have their own government. See, that's never happened ever, right? They don't ever even explain the basic 1-2-3 of the situation at all. For as far as their narrative sounds anyway to the uneducated ear, Palestine is the country next door, and those damn terrorists won't leave the poor Israelis alone. You know, there is no occupation. What occupation?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a perception that somehow Palestine is some kind of state with its own army and its own, a terrorist army. And there is this perception on American television. And instead, of course, what exists of Palestine is just a couple of enclaves that are kind of linked together a little bit, divided by Israeli roads. And essentially the rest of the West Bank stays under occupation or stays, under, as they put it, under Israeli security control, which is the same thing.
Yeah. Now General Mattis came out, and I forget now, he was the head of CENTCOM recently, right? I forget now.
Right.
He was after Petraeus?
Yeah.
And so he and Petraeus both, the heads of Central Command, have both been on the record saying that American support for Israeli policy in general is a security risk to their soldiers, basically. That's the way they think is, you know, this puts my men at risk, right? That's the way Army guys talk. And
yeah, that's correct. They both said that, and of course, Petraeus was forced to apologize when he when spoke to the Senate after that. But mm-hmm. That's normal. It's just the question is, is American 100% support of everything Israel does in our interest? And of course it's not. I mean, it's just that the question itself sounds stupid. But the fact is that's the way the Washington elite plays the game, as if that were true, that Israel and the United States have exactly the same interests and everything is in common. And that's you're going to see this play out over the next few days, I think, with Iran. With the discussion about the Iranian nuclear program, it's clear to me, and I'm not really particularly biased on the issue, that Iran wants a deal. And here's an opportunity to end, you know, 40 years of tension. And I have a feeling that we're the ones that are going to choke, and it's going to be for the usual reason that the Israel lobby does not want this. And so we will make a huge, huge mistake.
Yeah, you know, that thing just kills me, too. It seems like, you know, I don't know what parts of the American establishment you got to get on board for this deal. Aren't they sick and tired of this? Don't they have the ability, especially now, to tell the Crystalites to just shut up? We don't care what you think, Bill, or anybody at Commentary Magazine. And Netanyahu, you know what? We know what's better for you. We want peace with Iran. That's going to be in Israel's best interest, not this constant conflict. And 3.6% is fine. Quit being whiny and quit being a baby about it and make a deal. I mean, the outlines of a very reasonable deal are right there, you know? We'll have all the assurance we need in the world. They're not making nukes and lift the sanctions.
Yep.
Oh,
yep.
Man. I'm sorry, Phil. We got to take this break real quick. Hang on the line for just about a minute and a half or two. We'll be right back, okay?
Sure. Okay.
All right. It's Phil Giraldi, former CIA and DIA, and now at the Council for the National Interest.org, the American Conservative, and antiwar.com. The latest is a government answerable to no one. Be right back after this. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the Journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Now, you know they publish great articles at fff.org every day, but their best stuff goes in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online, and I got a new one coming out in September in there, U.S. Responsible for Somalia's Misery. Support FFF. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe, and tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all, welcome back to the thing here. I'm Scott Horton. This is the show, Scott Horton Show, talking with Phil Giraldi from the Council for the National Interest. And sorry we got interrupted by the break there, and I was going on too long anyway. Phil, what's your position on my little rant there about isn't anyone in the American establishment sick and tired of this nonsense and ready to really go ahead and make a deal? How can they blow this? It's such an obvious opportunity. And, you know, they were reduced, the war party was reduced last week to saying, oh, yeah, well, as long as he doesn't renounce the Holocaust, well, then that we shouldn't make a nuclear deal with him. Well, now he's even denounced the Holocaust, too. So, come on, let's shake hands here. It'll be fun. It'll be great. Doesn't everyone at the Council on Foreign Relations agree with me other than Elliot Abrams, or what the hell?
Well, the Council on Foreign Relations is kind of a neocon hangout anyway. So I wouldn't look to them for any wisdom. The fact is a lot of people from the traditional foreign policy establishment and the intelligence community and the Pentagon, let's not leave them out, are basically in favor of a deal here. The question will become ultimately, whether Obama feels strong enough to take the political heat to cut a deal. And my feeling is he won't, because he's basically demonstrated he's a coward on numerous other issues, and I think that basically he's going to back down here too. It's a question of, he is thinking of, you and I might be thinking about peace in the world, but he is thinking about 2014. So he's thinking about midterm elections, he's thinking about, he doesn't need the media to be going after the Democratic Party for cutting a deal with a bunch of terrorists. And he doesn't need that kind of, you know, subscript. And I think that's basically, you know, what the problem is. It's a question of, you know, they don't have the courage to make the right choice.
Yeah, it's too bad. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm a broken record, but it's just so easy for me to imagine President Paul up there saying, I don't even have to make a deal with you. Just all threats are canceled. Forget it. You know, that's it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Or anyone with any kind of sense of anything. You know, it doesn't require a genius to do some of these things. It's just that peace is better than war, and if there's any way to defuse this issue, you do it.
Right. And politically, too, anybody ought to be able to spin peace well. Oh, yeah, you know, the other guys would have preferred we had a violent armed conflict. Is that what you really want? I solved it without bombing. Come on, everybody. Three cheers for me. I think the American people are ready to hear a slogan like that. It's the same kind of criticism I have about Rand Paul. You know, Ron Paul said, hey, America had a foreign policy before 9/11. Did you know that? And Jennifer Rubin and everybody denounced him. And Rand refused to stand up for him. And by the way, Jennifer Rubin, you can find YouTube of Rand Paul saying the exact same thing if you look hard enough. But anyway, Rand Paul refused to back up his dad. That, you know what? Actions have consequences. Sorry. But the truth is, if he would go ahead and be brave on the war and peace issue for real and not all, you know, wishy-washy about it, he would do better that way. Instead of trying, he has the same Obama policy of trying to kind of halfway it or in some cases even outflank the war party on the right.
Yeah, that's the problem. I think Rand is too clever by a half, as the English would put it. He's always trying to kind of, you know, outsmart the opposition, and it means that the positions he takes are essentially illogical and unsustainable. This constant harping on cutting foreign aid for those who are burning our flag and you know, calling death to America. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's a comment of an idiot, and basically you cut foreign aid because foreign aid basically doesn't work apart from anything else, and you cut it for everybody. But you know, Rand Paul to me has yet to prove that he's anything but an empty suit.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing about voting for Rand's sanctions is just so he can say, well, I voted for the sanctions. Come on. You know, the sanctions were going to pass anyway. Could have made a courageous stand against punishing civilians.
Yeah, that's right. And we're not going to see much courage out of him, I don't think. I mean, the people who are passionate about him, I think, believe that if he gets elected, suddenly he's going to be a different man when he gets in office. But I don't think so. He's going to be the same guy cutting the same kind of corners and looking over his shoulder to see, you know, who's going to be coming out against him and so on. I mean, that's what they all do. They're all basically they're corrupt people. If they weren't corrupt people, they wouldn't be in politics. Mr. Smith goes to Washington, doesn't work anymore.
Yeah. Well, hey, you know, the election of 2018 is coming up, those midterms. Very important, so. We can't blow
it. Well, they're always looking for the next election, exactly.
Yeah. All right, well, and then so Syria, give me your comment real quick on the deal. I guess it's the UN Security Council version of it is still stalled, last I heard, but on the ground it seems to be working, correct? The Russia deal?
Well, it seems that the Russians have worked out some modus vivendi for actually doing this stuff on the ground. Now, the question is, to what extent the United States will be pushing for automatic military action of some kind if they're not happy with the result? So I think that's why the resolution is stalled at the moment. But, again, the U.S. is looking for this option to start another war if that's what they seem to be appropriate.
Mm-hmm. And then would you agree with me that it makes sense for the Russians to really make sure to follow through with this their very best that they can? Because if they do, they're really erasing even the possibility of the red line, and they're de facto getting an agreement from America to not remove Assad. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, I think basically the Russians see this as a way of first of all resolving the issue, and secondly, it basically makes the Russians a much bigger player, so they have a self interest in it too. But I think it's in our interest too. There's no question it's in our interest also.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, of course, again, that's not what counts. But you know, least we've got you know, Putin at bat for us. You know, we got to rely on leaders of foreign empires to protect us from our own here, Phil.
That's right, from our own bad judgment.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
All right. Well, but then how long do you think it'll take? I guess we have very little time here, but are they really going to be able to just collect all these canisters, load them up on planes, and ship them off to Russia in any reasonable period of time?
Well, it depends on how you define reasonable period of time. A lot of this stuff is not located centrally, so they're going to have to go around and pick it up. It'll take a while.
All right. Anyway, we're out of time. All right. Thanks very much, Phil. Good talk to you again.
Okay,
appreciate
Scott.
It.
Bye. Bye-bye.
All right, everybody. That's Phil Giraldi, the Council for the National Interest, councilforthenationalinterest.org, the American Conservative Magazine, and antiwar.com. A government answerable to no one is his piece at antiwar.com today. We'll be right back. Hey, all Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom. The history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the show. Our next guest is John Glazer. When I invited him on the show last week, we were supposed to talk about Syria, but then we talked about Iran the whole time. So now I want to talk about Syria, but also Iran, too. And also other things. Palestine. Welcome back to the show, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me back.
Very good to have you here. You write for antiwar.com, especially slash blog, but also news.antiwar.com, and the Huffington Post, and the Washington Times, and aljazeera.net, or is that america.aljazeera.com? And am I leaving out anything else?
That you've got it fine there. That's enough.
Okay, good. Well, and it's a good thing you do, too, because people need to read what you're writing. That's my opinion. Lots of things to discuss here. I guess, first of all, I wanted to bring up, did you see where over at the Mondo Weiss blog, they've got a little thing about it, about all these Republicans palling around with the Mujahideen e Kalk yesterday, including Michael Steele and Rudy Giuliani, Mr. 9/11. Oh, and also Patrick Kennedy was there, too.
I did not see the piece at Mondo Weiss, but, you know, it's been known for a long time that it's a bipartisan issue, unfortunately. Many former and current members of Congress of both parties have teamed up with MEK. They've given speeches with, you know, huge speaking fees that they've been paid. And they're otherwise financially associated with MEK, which is, you know, it's an Iranian dissident group who used to be on the United States list of officially designated terrorist organizations and seeks the overthrow of the Iranian government. You know, it's not uncommon for the United States to team up with opposition groups in countries that we want to overthrow and in countries that we view as adversaries. We've been doing that for a very, very long time. And unfortunately, this is another example of that.
Well, I thought it was ironic. It says here that Rudy Giuliani says he's accusing Rouhani, the new president of Iran, of being linked to the 1994 bombing of the Jewish Center in Buenos Aires, Argentina, which is a little bit hilarious because Gareth Porter, of course, just a few weeks ago uncovered the fact that it was actually the Mujahideen-e-Khalq that made up the so-called fact that Hezbollah and Iran were responsible for that attack in the first place, which Gareth has long shown was much more likely to have been carried out by white right-wingers, anti-Semite types in the security services there than any agents of Hezbollah or Iran.
Yeah, leave it to Gareth, the meticulous debunker. He's great.
Yeah, indeed. And leave it to Rudy Giuliani to pal around with a communist terrorist cult, to pal around with anybody called the Mujahideen all anything. What in the hell?
I know. It's this extremely guy. Ironic.
It's crazy, dude. All right. Well, yeah, of course, opposition to Iran comes first. Uber alles, right? No matter what. All right. So now... speaking of which, Phil Giraldi was just on the show, and he was saying that he thinks that Israeli interests are going to come between America and Iran on this deal, And I was wondering, with the developments of the last few days, what you think about that. Do you think there's a possibility that Obama really have Kerry really work something out? Because Rouhani and the Iranians seem to really be pushing hard to say, no, we really want to make a deal with you, which is kind of, it'll be at least a little bit embarrassing if the Americans don't at least seem to really try, right?
Yeah, so I see a couple things possibly happening. I mean, I think if history is any judge, the bulk of Obama's political career shows that Obama does things not because he's courageous and, you know, he wants to break new ground, but because it's going to be politically palatable for him and his constituents and his party. So, when, you know, any possible deal with Iran is thought about in the context of the White House, in the context of you know, the next election. So either getting someone Democratic into the White House in 2016 or in 2014, you know, getting a majority in Democrats in the House or something like this. And so he has to keep that palatable. And, you know, I don't have much confidence in Obama to, you know, make the case for peace, the public case for peace anyways. I don't think that he wants to, you know, go to war with Iran or bomb Iran or whatever. And I think that he probably does view Rouhani's overtures as serious because, you know, he's been exchanging letters and so on and so forth. So, you know, these are good signs, but I for one am very pessimistic, and you know, we'll sort of have to see. One of the things that is true about this is that however legitimate and serious these diplomatic overtures between the U.S. and Iran are, there's a very short time span for them to actually be effective. You know, there's a these things go bad like a pear. They're just overnight and they're no longer ripe. And so that's because hardliners in both countries sort of get on their haunches and say, oh, this is how it's not working. This is, you know, the other side's not making enough concessions and so on and so forth. So it gets very bad very quick. And so if anything is going to happen that's positive and substantive, it's going to have to happen really, really soon.
Well, yeah, and, you know, it sounds like the kind of thing of just, you know, some crank's complaint, but it's a true thing that back in October of 2009, when there was the best chance that we've had so far for them to come to this nuke swap deal, something or other, the Israelis had the Jundallah, Al-Qaeda-ish terrorists in Baluchistan commit attacks, terrorist attacks inside Iran, which made the domestic political atmosphere in their country, you know, shift hard against making a deal. And they're willing to go to those lengths. Go back and look that up. In fact, I don't know how I had missed that. I had been so caught up in the fake outing of the secret Fordo facility at the time. I had somehow missed the correlation, or at least I didn't remember it well in my own little narrative there. But it was Ray McGovern, the former CIA analyst, that reminded me. Go back and Google it. 2009, October 2009, right when Obama's trying to make a deal. Well, so-called trying anyway. Jundallah, working for Israel, starts blowing stuff up in Iran.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at broader interests, even the most unseasoned political observer can look at the headlines in the past few weeks and see that Netanyahu doesn't want any sort of negotiations with Iran. You know, with Israel-Palestine, he at least says, okay, let's have negotiations as a cover for, you know, Israeli expansionism into the West Bank and essentially annexation. But with Iran, he just wants nothing, no negotiations. And the reason is he's not party to those negotiations, because if he were, he'd be disrupting them and undermining them. But with two parties, the U.S. and Iran, which could conceivably want to actually do something substantive, he has no ability to undermine them, and so he doesn't want them to happen. And this has been the case. I mean, go back to 2001 after 9/11, the Iran, you know, issued condolences, and then they helped us overthrow the Taliban and install the Karzai government in Afghanistan. And then they, you know, there was a possible detente. The Iranians wanted Washington strategic help and vice versa. And then right after that, President Bush said, oh, Iran's in the axis of evil. 2 years later, the same team of Iranian officials offered the Bush administration what they called a grand bargain. They made numerous concessions. They said, we'll open up our nuclear program for even more transparency. We'll collaborate with the United States in Iraq. We will restrain Hamas. We'll even consider stop aiding and giving weapons to Hezbollah. I mean, this is all like a wet dream to Washington and Israel, and yet the Bush administration rejected the offer out of hand. So, look, Iranians have made diplomatic overtures for peace in the past, and they've been dismissed out of hand by the United States. And we talked the last time about how if you're a cold, calculating, realpolitik realist sitting in Washington, there are a number of reasons that a detente with Iran makes a lot of sense. It's better for our interests. But time and again, the United States pushes its interests out of the way in favor of Israeli interests, and that seems like what's going to happen now unless a real big change happens that I can't predict.
Yeah. Well, and then that brings us to Syria and American and Israeli support for the Mujahideen in a contest between... To oversimplify it, in a contest between Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah, America has sided with Al-Qaeda against Hezbollah because Hezbollah is Israel's enemy. And
right.
Michael Oren made that clear that, hey, look, this is the choice we've made, and he didn't have to say, and therefore have made for you, too.
The since the very beginning of the conflict in Syria, you and me and every other sensible person has said, look, these rebels are mostly extremists, and even the ones that aren't extremists don't have our interests at heart, and it would be they're committing crimes, and it's just a horrible idea for us to go ahead and support these guys. From the very beginning, and, you know, even way back in the beginning, most people in the mainstream, you know, dismissed this, oh, the United States is supporting Al-Qaeda because it's just too much of an oversimplification, and it's sort of too broad and too sort of duh, right? Smack you over the head with a 4x4. But it's becoming more and more literally the case that the United States is in the process of supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria. Yesterday, McClatchy News reported that more than a dozen of Syria's most effective rebel forces, including factions of the rebels that are aligned with the Free Syrian Army and backed by the United States, have formed a new alliance with al-Qaeda affiliates, including Jabhat al-Nusra, which, of course, the Obama administration has put on the State Department's list of terrorist organizations. Okay, so we are literally giving aid and comfort and money and weapons to rebel factions in Syria that are aligned with al-Qaeda. And these are groups that we're directly giving money to, as opposed to this nonsense about, you know, which is obviously true, that even if you put weapons into Syria and try to get them to so-called moderate rebels, they will eventually get into the hands of extremists. No. We're directly giving them to extremists. These guys said that they want to set up an Islamic state in Syria that is based on Sharia law. They specifically rejected, in their announcement of this alliance, the Syrian Opposition Coalition, which is the civilian group that's headquartered in Turkey that Obama promoted as an officially accepted by the United States alternative to the Assad regime. Okay? This is just too blatant. I was reminded when I heard the news of when John Kerry went in front of the Congress earlier in September. This was in the midst of the propaganda crusade to bomb Syria. Mm-hmm. And he said that the opposition in Syria has quote, increasingly become more defined by its moderation, its adherence to democratic process, and a broad-based and secular future. A day or two later, Reuters reported that Kerry's statements were, quote, at odds with estimates by the U.S. and European intelligence sources. In other words, he lied. It's been the debate over, you know, whether and how to support Syria's quote-unquote moderate opposition should have been over long ago, but I'm afraid even with this obvious news that makes it all too blatantly true that we're aiding al-Qaeda, I'm afraid that it still won't end the debate.
Yeah. Well, and of course it was Kerry was going back and forth with McCain about how much they agreed with each other, that we don't have to worry about Islamic extremism on the part of the rebels here, because after all, Syria is a secular something, kind of the verbal dot, dot, dot. And what they meant to say was, right now it has a secular coalition minority government, and once it's overthrown, it'll no longer be secular nothing. You know, they couldn't finish their sentence because the rest of their sentence was going to be true. Oops.
Yeah, McCain's on a completely different planet on this. I mean, he's out in the forefront of saying boldly that the Syrian opposition deserves our help and they aren't extremists and da-da-da-da. I've met with them, he cries. And John Kerry was trying to placate that sort of sentiment in order to convince Congress that it was necessary to bomb Syria. And he even felt shy about it sometimes. You're right. His body language was all reluctant. But he slipped this one time, and he said, no, dude, the opposition is increasingly moderate and blah, 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 blah. And it was an absolute outright lie. And McCain will believe anything that satisfies his own preconceived notions of U.S. intervention. So he's just on a different world. He can believe whatever he wants to. But, you know, this is not going to get any better. The rebel opposition is not increasingly moderate. It's increasingly extremist. And U.S. intervention will only make things worse.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can't, on the point about McCain there real quick, I can't figure out why this doesn't get more traction, at least in alternative type media. It seems like it's such an easy 2+2=4 kind of a thing where McCain, the leader of the We Can Vet the Rebels and Pick the Good Guys to Back movement, as you're describing there, he went at, it was, the whole thing was arranged by the imposter, the fake Obagi and her, probably CIA front group, whatever she's working for there, and
right.
Arranged this meet with McCain where he wanted, according to the Daily Caller anyway, according to Obagi, he wanted to spend the night with these guys, and they were the Northern Storm Brigade, and even if it wasn't the men in the picture who were the kidnappers, it was still the Northern Storm Brigade who were the kidnappers of the Shiite pilgrims from Lebanon. And if you just Google Northern Storm Brigade, the first freaking thing that comes up is a Time magazine interview with them all, where at least one of them is saying, yeah, I'm a veteran of the Iraq War, where I fought against the Americans as part of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And this is the guys, the Northern Storm Brigade. McCain, Iraq War veteran, together. Why am I the only one who keeps stuttering over this freaking thing, man? This is the biggest thing of them all. And it directly contradicts his point. He's the leader of this thing. And it's just, I don't know, man. Anyway.
I mean, one of the things that is so frustrating about McCain and the way that the media covers him is that he is a true crazy. Like, he's actually sincere in his beliefs. A lot of these other schmucks in politics say things, they use buzzwords, they use the, you know, officially approved phrases that will get us to a certain point, but they don't believe it. And so, like, for example, when Kerry said in Congress, and I just told you, and then Reuters reported, like, the very next day, oh, that is actually not true, and it's
right.
Contrary to the intelligence that Kerry has been receiving.
Right.
Can't do that with McCain, because McCain is a true believer. He's like a religious zealot for U.S. interventionism, and you can't penetrate his extreme faith. You know, so it's harder to sort of pin him on it, and the media is kind of afraid of him, I feel like.
And by the way, I wanted to mention real quick about this report that you referred to in McClatchy. U.S. Syria plans face setback as key rebels break from coalition. One of the reporters on this is Jonathan Landay, the guy who got more than, three dozen or something stories, right? More than that, four or five dozen stories, right, about the intelligence before the Iraq war, and has done excellent national security reporting ever since then. So the fact that his brand name is on this story makes it that much more citable to me. I like pointing that out whenever it's his work. He deserves it. All right, and then I'm sorry, we're pretty short on time. We got, 7-8 minutes. Please tell us all about the ethnic cleansing of the Bedouins. Boy, talk about an unreported story here.
I know, it's a completely, it's just non-existent in the U.S. media. You won't hear about it because it's too embarrassing for Israel. The military has been demolishing homes in the Bedouin communities in Israel and Palestine, and they're displacing the population with intent. It's intended to displace the residents, and that's illegal, and in fact it's a war crime, and Human Rights Watch pointed that out today or yesterday. And, you know, this should be understood in the context of the supposed campaign by the Obama administration to get the Israelis and the Palestinians to talk and have some sort of political settlement that's based on a two-state solution, which is an impossibility because of what Israel is doing every single day, bulldozing new homes, building new construction settlements. It just can't happen when you have an expansionist, annexationist state that is undermining the very basis of negotiations, which is two states for two people. One thing that I just want to point out is what is his name? Yusuf Meneir. I butchered his last name. But he wrote in The New Yorker recently about a national intelligence estimate by the U.S. Intelligence community back in 1968, so 1 year after the 67 war. And it said if Israel continues to settle in the West Bank, it'll be impossible to relinquish control, and they'll never turn back. The Arabs will just be either an apartheid regime or they'll be ousted the way they were in the Nakba. They said this in 68, that it was going to be impossible to reverse this trend towards settlement. And now we're at the point where 650,000, maybe 700,000 Jewish settlers are in.
Wait, John, your phone just got all crappy on me. Try again.
Sorry, I was just saying that we have now about 650,000, maybe 700,000 Jewish settlers on Palestinian land. Mm-hmm. And if back in 1968 they were talking about this being irreversible, it's surely irreversible now. And so the whole basis of the negotiations is merely works as a cover for Israel to continue to annex the rest of Palestinian land. They're just confiscating it. It's absolutely illegal. And we shouldn't be surprised if no movement on the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations takes place at all. This just makes me wonder why in the world they're wasting time on it. Why is John Kerry going back and forth thinking he can bring these two sides together when one of the sides, Israel, is undermining the very basis of the point of his attempt to negotiate?
Yeah. Well, you know, I wonder if it all goes back to what we were talking about with Phil in the last segment about Obama turning over all of the NSA's catch to the Israelis, including everything they got on the Senate and everybody else. And you know, it's funny because when they negotiate, what they talk about is a ridiculous fake state anyway. You know, I remember Eric Garris saying back in 05 that it could really be a problem. You get the last of the Jewish settlers out of Gaza, they're sort of human shields there. And they kind of limit how bad Israel can crack down on the Palestinians in Gaza. And once they're gone, it'll be just the prison by the sea, which is exactly what happened. So, you know, if they got all the settlers somehow out of the West Bank, not that they ever mean to, even according to the plan, or whatever land swaps were, they would never let that state be what we would call a state anyway. It would have no foreign policy of its own, no taxation authority of its own, no authority of its own.
Yeah, whenever they talk about what the possibility of a future Palestinian state, they say it has to be demilitarized so you can't defend yourselves. We're going to have a lot of the natural resources, including the water resources in the West Bank, because certain settlements will stay there and they're under control of those. So it'll be a completely neutered state. And it won't, of course, it's completely unacceptable to any decent Palestinian. But, you know, it's important to note that Gaza, you know, they left Gaza and sort of played it up as some sort of concession. But Gaza is less religiously important to Zionist Jews than the West Bank is. You know, it's very important to them in their religious canon and their beliefs, what they call Judea and Samaria. So, you know, I don't think that we can expect any settlements to be reduced or leave. No Jewish settlers are going back to Israel from the West Bank. They're meant there, and they're meant to stay there because Israel wants the West Bank for itself. They don't want to share. They want everything west of the Jordan River as an Israeli Jewish state. Basically, Palestinians are going to suffer under apartheid until they get what they want. And what's worse is that this could all be solved in a second if the United States would just stop its irrational support for Israel. Everything Israel does in the West Bank and in Gaza is able to be done because of U.S. weapons, U.S. money, and U.S. diplomatic support. That is the reason it occurs. Otherwise, the whole support system under Israel would just evaporate. They wouldn't be able to get away with this stuff. So the U.S. is extremely culpable for the ongoing suffering of the Palestinians, the ongoing confiscation of their land, and their dashed hopes for any sort of state.
Well, so what about the one state thing? Is there a possibility of that? You got 30 seconds.
It's conceivable, but only, I mean, not Israel can't be a quote-unquote Jewish state, if that's the case, because they're going to have a massive Arab-Palestinian population that believes in Islam. And if, unless they respect their rights, they can't be the democratic Jewish state that they want. They're just going to have to be a Jewish theocratic state that continues to mistreat the Arab population.
Which I guess leaves the Israelis force marching them into the Jordan River or something at this point.
Right. It's not
ship them by train all to Gaza.
Right.
All right. Anyway, I'm sorry. We're all out of time. Good luck, Palestinians. Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
All right.
That's John Glazer, everybody, from antiwar.com, The Huffington Post, The Washington Times, Al Jazeera. And we'll see y'all tomorrow. Thanks for listening.